and welcome to edition 408 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Marcus Hippie.
On this week's show, we'll be talking to foreign correspondent Judith Matloff about her new book, The War is in the Mountains, which looks at why some of the most inaccessible and sparsely populated regions on Earth are often the most volatile.
Plus, a genuine musical legend, Booker T. Jones, the man behind soul hits such as Green Onions and countless others with the likes of Otis Redding, Bill Withers and more, will be explaining why music can still have a message in 2017.
And we'll be talking art, design and a bit of urbanism with Lebanese artist Nadim Karam.
All that plus Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan with the news look ahead and most likely some more music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. What happy Sunday lunchtime fellows we make.
I just realised it's been such a busy week that we haven't had time to actually enjoy any sort of chat.
My head is buried, my earphones are in, exactly. So don't look at me, don't even look at me, kind of.
Exactly, that's why it's always good to see you a bit more relaxed on a Sunday to get to,
right.
You know, to do this show.
But do you know what's been on my laptop? Sure, some articles for Monocle, but mostly I'm in the process of finishing the work on the house. I won't say without a lot of help from other people that share my surname.
Oh, yes, you have
parents.
A new place. You have a new
but now
place
I have,
now.
Yeah, but you find yourself, when you do this, with strange new accounts. Not just, you know, maybe a bit of Amazon here, a bit of this, that and the other there. Screwfix, are you familiar with a company called Screwfix? Yep. It's not as exciting as it sounds.
I know.
It does sound a bit like a dating app, though, doesn't
but,
it?
But
we can fix you up for a screw anywhere you want.
Exactly.
Sadly, it's not. It's
but
nails.
Isn't it great to actually have a place of your own you're actually going to start working with and, you know, to kind of create it to make it look like what you've always
it's
wanted?
It's now looking more like a house than a building. So
exactly. I think it's interesting. I was just talking to a friend of mine about what my style would be if I bought my own place and decorated. Then I don't know if it's a good or bad thing, but I realised that my place would pretty much look like Midori House.
Yeah, mine does a bit, actually. But that's its style. It's kind of modern. It's modern. It's 50s modern.
Relatively
kind of thing,
simple.
You know? Yeah, relatively simple. And also, we've got to do a big shout out for Speedy Tool Hire, of course, who have obviously been another one of my weird favourites. It's going to take a lot of time to recorrect or to correct the favourites on that pop up when I open my laptop now. It used to be kind of moments of great cultural learning, and now it's Screwfix and juicing, but it's fine.
A new dimension in your life.
It's a new dimension. Marcus, let's keep it clean because it is a family show, but talk us through some of the favourites in your bookmarks.
In my bookmarks, you mean what's been happening in the last 7 days in my life? Well, you may have noticed that I wasn't here in the beginning of the week. I was enjoying family time, actually.
Were you?
My parents were visiting London.
Oh, right.
We were doing a bit of touristy stuff in London.
What were you doing? What did you tick off the list with the other hippies?
Well, I went to Sky Garden. That is the rooftop bar / restaurant / viewing platform on top of Walkie Talkie, one of the tall buildings in the city.
Okay, no, I'm not.
You get
had
a
the
nice
pleasure.
View. You get a nice view over London. What else did we do? Went to Greenwich.
Yeah.
Had a few pints.
Nice.
My parents turned out to be quite a big fans of the British pop culture.
Really?
Yeah.
What were you talking about? A sort of hippie night out. Who's the big drinker in the family?
I think it's me.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's see if we can inculcate some of that kind of vibe, some of the hippie kind of pub crawl vibe into this edition of the Monocle Weekly. How do you think we're going to fare?
Let's see. Let's talk about this by the end of the show.
I think our listeners will know by the end of the show. I think who the kind of person you'd like to take on a pub crawl? The man who knows what's going to happen next, the one and only Henry Rhys Sheridan. Henry, oh Henry. Hi, Henry.
Hi, Rob. Hi, Marcus.
Hello, Henry. How has your week been so far?
It's good. The image of a bunch of hippies storming the Sky Garden captured my imagination.
You make it sound like you made it sound like we're a bunch of Teletubbies on a tour around London, but we don't.
It sounds more like the Occupy movement.
That's what I was thinking. I am interested in Marcus's Teletubby interpretation. Perhaps that has to do with particular family dynamics we're not party to, but
yeah,
I'll leave that where it lays.
I should save some hippie stories until the end of this programme. But Henry, the reason why you are joining us in this Midori House Studio One is to tell us what's happening in the course of the next seven days.
So probably the most significant event that's going to happen in the course of the next 7 days, as you know, is the French election on the 7th of May. That's going to be going out next Sunday. We'll be on air while the French are voting. But I want to talk about a different but related event, which is the French far-right party Front National is going to celebrate the anniversary of Joan of Arc's birth, as is their wont, by marching through the streets of Paris. And I thought we could just use this event as an opportunity to reflect on the tumultuous history of the Front National, of course, the party of Marine Le Pen, up until last Tuesday when she announced that she was stepping aside from party concerns.
For a bit.
For a little bit, to concentrate on the presidency shot. Looking back into the history of the party, I remembered really weird historical aspects of it. So it was founded, of course, by Marine Le Pen's dad, Jean-Marie, where he was kicked out of the party after a public feud with Marine.
A fight in a pub there.
Yeah, no,
that's a public feud. Okay.
For rather embarrassingly denying the Holocaust, which is something that he'd done before, but I think has in the meantime...
Did you call it a detail of history?
I think those were his words.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is an ongoing family spat.
Anyway, what else is happening?
So, Marcus, if you need something to celebrate today, and if this Sunday is like any other of your Sundays, I'm sure you are in dire need of that. The 6th International Jazz Day is taking place from UNESCO.
Yay.
It was initiated, apparently, in order to raise awareness of the virtues of jazz as an educational tool, a force for peace, unity, dialogue, and enhanced cooperation among people.
And 16-minute bass solos.
I think expectations are
quite
high.
Sorry, that's in there too.
Do you think these kind of days work? Actually, there are so many days. I feel like every day there is something going on. It's the official pie day. It's the official whatever day.
Yeah.
I just thought this was interesting because it's an unusually specific... You know, the UN does quite like to attach their mission to kind of sometimes quite tangential pegs.
Yeah.
And finally... And this is something which I know you'll have strong opinions on.
Okay.
On the 1st of May, the annual Black Autumn International Festival of Worm Charming is taking place.
This is more like it.
What is worm charming?
So let me explain the rules of the competition, which is the centrepiece of this international festival. There's a competition to charm as many worms out of the ground by any means possible, except by mechanical digging or forking of the ground. The team with the most worms after 15 minutes wins. So let me take you through a couple of the most popular techniques.
Please.
Probably the most prominent is worm grunting.
Okay. Have you been on YouTube? Have you seen this?
I have. I can give the producer Tom a video
can
after.
Can you do some grunting?
And because it is actually quite sonically engaging. Mm. It basically involves using something called a stob, which is a wooden stake driven into the earth, and a rooping iron, which is used, of course, Rob, to rub the stob.
Okay.
And the vibrations...
This definitely isn't a medieval torture technique. This
activity.
Definitely this.
It brings the worms up. There's also worm fiddling, of course.
Yeah, big time.
Similar in terms of the mechanics, but a dulled saw is used and is dragged along the top of the stake instead of a rooping iron.
Where does this go back to? Whereabouts in England is this, if indeed it is in England?
Well, it's actually a very ancient technique which has been used to get worms out of the ground to use as bait.
Okay.
By fishermen. So, and there are actually professional bait catchers who use these traditional techniques to procure the worms, and which they sell on an industrial level. So it's no laughing matter for them. But I think the event in a... Black Orton.
Where's Black
Orton? It's in Devon, I think.
Okay.
It's either in Devon or Cornwall. You're really not meant to get those two confused, are you? People get quite offended, I think. Done it.
Well, it's fine. I think it's good rural stuff. I think this is the kind of thing that to bring in the spring. I think this is good.
Sounds like a great hobby, actually.
Do you think there'll be? Do you think it is specifically focused on worm charming, or do you think there are other sort of satellite events?
I get the feeling.
No, strictly worm charming.
I get the feeling that there's going to probably be some Morris dancers.
There's going to be a coconut shy.
Loitering around the periphery.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
I quite like to go to this. When is it?
Yeah, so that's going to be on the 1st of May. Head down there if you
want.
Bank
holiday weekend. Come on.
Amazing.
Come on, Marcus. You said we didn't get to hang out enough. Let's do it.
I can see you.
Tomorrow.
I can imagine you grunting some worms, Marcus. No?
Maybe.
Thank you, Henry. The journalist and author Judith Matloff was a foreign correspondent for over 20 years, serving in locations ranging from Moscow to Burundi and reporting for organisations including the New York Times, Reuters and The Economist. And her expertise in safety training for journalists has been utilised by groups ranging from NBC to the UN.
Now teaching at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, her latest project is a book, The War is in the Mountains. It looks at why some of the world's most remote regions fuel some of its most volatile conflicts. And she joins us now to talk about it. Judith, welcome to The Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
So you told us already beforehand that you've been working with this book for 8 years and you have travelled about 72,000 miles. But if we start from the very beginning, how did you start to wonder about the connection between mountainous regions and conflicts?
It's the most prosaic and random story. The men in my family, my son and my husband, love to play the game Risk.
I love that foreign correspondents play Risk, by the way.
Well, we also play chess, but okay. But this sounds better. But I personally...
Like detectives playing Cluedo. I like it. Yeah.
Or real estate agents playing Monopoly.
Exactly.
I personally, unlike you, don't really like the game because I don't know how your games go, but ours go on for days and days and days. Yeah. So there we were playing. We had our son, I think, was 10 or 11 at the time, and it had been going on for 5 hours. And his father had rampaged into Afghanistan, and like everybody else, we were battling over it. My kid was losing, so he wanted to distract everybody. So he said, Mom, get a globe. Show me where you've covered conflicts and where they are right now. So I brought a globe over, very glad to have the breaks.
Very cynical 11-year-old you've got there.
Yeah.
Tell me about this conflict thing.
And so I brought the globe over, and I'm pointing to places, and then he would touch them, too, very tactile type of thing, too. And he said, Mom, do you realize, like, most of these places are in the mountains? And I said, oh, that might explain why I'm always packing altitude sickness pills when I go on assignment. And then he said, Mom, why do you think that is? And I said, I really have no idea. So then the following week, I was having drinks with my literary agent. I was boasting about how clever my kid was. And she looked at me and she said, that's your next book.
And what happened then?
Well, the kid now wants half the advance. And he's very angry that his name is not on the cover.
Yeah, right. Okay. So what's the problem? Is it something in the topography? Is it people from the mountains are a little bit insular? They're kind of a protective of their bit as opposed to the other guy's bit? Or is it just people from all over the world having their wars in mountains?
It's all of the above. I think the geography, the geographic isolation creates an existential isolation as well. People are indeed very insular. You know, these are usually minority groups, and they're usually the most marginalized people in the world. Mountains are the last place that you build roads, that you build plumbing, that you build schools and clinics. And they're oftentimes places where indigenous people live. So they're usually the lowest strata in society. And in nearly every society, the power elite, be it economic or political, is in the plains, generally. So already you've got some people, they're living in very tight insular cultures, very geographically all bunched up together. They're minorities, and they really resent when people come in. And then you look at the geography, which is no conventional army has ever overcome a local irregular military armed group.
In the mountains?
In the mountains, never.
Yeah.
The only person who came closest was Alexander the Great in Bactria, which is now Afghanistan. And the way he did it wasn't by military brutality. He simply co-opted them by marrying a warlord's daughter and then encouraging his troops to do the same. But due to the terrain, you know, they're holding high ground. They're embedded in the local population. It's very, very difficult terrain. You can't get airplanes up there. You can't get tanks. And so people will really dig in and fight.
How similar are the identities then in all those mountainous regions? You've been going through them. Would you talk about such thing as a mountain identity?
Well, this is the thing. When I started out, I thought, gee, maybe there is a mountain identity, but I didn't want to seem like one of these flatland chauvinists who make gross generalizations. So what happened was, you know, I didn't want to seem like one of these geographic determinists. You know, I didn't want to seem like some narrow-minded person who had gross generalizations about other people who weren't like me. And then I met a group called the World Mountain People Association. This is a world organization that was set up at the start of the millennium, and it covers mountain people from 70 different countries. And they meet every year on somebody's mountain. this year they're going to meet in Morocco, and they gripe about flatland chauvinism, and they talk about their commonalities. And they were telling me, look, we have something in common. We do have a common identity. We have common gripes. And they listed things from the insularity to the fact that, for instance, mountain people tend to have communal grazing lands. You don't find that in the plains, usually. So after I spoke to them, I thought, well, they know better than I do because they're mountain people. There it happened.
Do you find that on the same mountain, that people think very differently from one side of the mountain to the other? How local are these squabbles? I know that your book obviously takes you from Afghanistan to Colombia, very different sorts of people you might think, but is it as different as close as the north and the south side of the hill?
There is very little unity from valley to valley. And when you look at, for instance, Papua New Guinea, which is a place wrought by conflict, they have more languages than anywhere else because of all the different valleys. Look at Afghanistan. One of the biggest problems of taming Afghanistan is that you have one valley, people speak one language, and then you go over the mountain and they speak another one. And then when you look at the North Caucasus, for instance, Dagestan, they've got 62 language groups. And oftentimes there's clan fighting. And likewise in Albania, which is covered in my book, you get clan fighting from one place to another.
So when you traveled through these regions, did you start thinking about all these conflicts differently? Did you start thinking of new ways of trying to solve them?
I did, and I came up with a solution that I'm sure nobody will listen to me, but I'll share it with you, which is I wanted to end the book with a contradictory case study. So what is the most peaceful place that we think of, an armed neutrality? It's Switzerland. So I thought, okay, I'll go to Switzerland. And it just so happened that my brother-in-law is an anthropologist who's head of the department there and at the University of Zurich. So I spoke to a bunch of anthropologists, and then I went around to these different cantons. And we tend to forget that just 180 years ago...
You used to fight like mad.
Yeah, and their big export was mercenaries. It wasn't chocolate or cuckoo clocks. And we forget that. But it was just 180 years ago. And the way they resolved it was they decided not to impose one national identity. So there are four languages, the two main religious groups coexist. And basically, power was devolved down to the lowest, most direct level, which is the canton. There are 62 cantons. And they're basically what we were talking about before, different valleys that are in many ways cut off from each other. And that's how you resolved it. And I just thought, all right, unfortunately, Turkey's not going to do that in Kurdistan. But the Spanish did it to a certain extent with the Basque Country. Because what they did is they poured in huge resources so that it wasn't a poor area. And then what they also did is they gave them an enormous amount of autonomy. And that basically sucked the blood out of the armed separatist movement.
Some of the people that feature in your book, if the Colombian read it, would he understand what the Afghan thought and vice versa, do you think? I wonder if there is a fellow feeling, maybe that's borne out by this Mountain People's Association.
Right. Well, I think
I've made that sound like a camping thing rather than a sort of UN of hilly folk, but you know what I mean.
No, they're very, very cuddly and cozy with each other. And it when you go to their meetings, it looks like, you know, a 1990s Benetton ad. You have a Sherpa sitting next to a Quechua Indian from Bolivia, sitting next to, you know, a French sheep herder from the Pyrenees. And the way the book actually opens is a very visual image of a very, very short man, shorter than I am. He's like 4'11", from an indigenous group in Ecuador. The head of the organization, who's a Frenchman, who's about 6'7". So there's about a foot in difference between the two men, but they talk about how they see eye to eye and they're brothers. And it was really quite visual to see this, but it was also, to me, very... It summed up the brotherhood that these folks feel.
What's also interesting is that you have pioneered safety training for journalists around the world. Say, if you go to these mountainous regions, what kind of things do you need to take into account?
Well, first of all, you have to have the right gear, very good hiking boots. Second of all, you don't just walk into a community which is up in arms. You'd have to make contact with them prior to leaving and make sure that they're ready to accept you and welcome you. It's like walking into a really fraught inner city neighborhood. You don't just go there. You go with a guide and somebody who can win trust for you. But other than that, the terrain varies. Most of these places, the only way in is via helicopter. Like when I was in the Andes covering the Colombian Civil War, which allegedly is over now but isn't due to the mountains, I went to this one base that was on the top of a mountain, and the sides of it were packed with explosives and tuna fish cans. So we couldn't even go up by mule, and there were no roads. The only way in was via helicopter, and that was the only way out.
That's a pretty good packing list then, right? We were saying, we were kind of thinking of maybe a spare pen, bulletproof vest, some good shoes. And you go, no, start with a helicopter, guys. What next then? Because at what point do you become flatland chauvinists? Is your next book going to be about flatland chauvinists? I feel that there is another, there is a great germ of an idea here, possibly.
Maybe. I'm meeting with my agent in 2 days, so let's see. I'm not going to write about swamp people. I mean, the interesting thing is you have the World Mountain People Association. You do not have the World Desert People Association. You don't have the World Swamp People Association. I mean, I think this is a very, very unique geographic feature which has an impact on the people who live there. I'm not necessarily convinced that islanders have this kind of brotherhood or similarity. Mm. But it would be really fun, though, wouldn't it? Like doing research for 6 years, going to beaches.
Yeah, you could do that. That'd be a good one.
I like this.
What happens at the end of the Congress of the Mountain People? I mean,
oh, they all hug each other.
They sort of hug each other, and they go off and have their wars, and sort of this time next year.
Yeah, and the hope is that for areas where development has increased, that people can go home with suggestions as to how to advocate for better resources or services in their areas. So there is a lot of swapping of information.
And you've been sort of alluding to this throughout our chat, but is it a sort of shared feeling of them being misunderstood that binds them together? Is that why this association exists?
Absolutely. Yeah, they feel their problems are very much the same. The same problems that I had mapped out at the beginning.
Yeah.
The sense of marginalization, not being heard, being ignored. You know, and what also really, really troubles them is when outsiders come in to exploit the resources. And that's a big issue right now in the Himalayas, because there's this explosion of hydroelectric dam building over the five countries that span the Himalayas. And this is not benefiting the people that live there, because they're flooded out. It only benefits the people in the lowlands who get the hydroelectric power, but the power isn't going to these people who actually live where the water is. Because water rises in the hills and the mountains, and then it flows down. Yeah. So you want your dam as high up as possible. But wherever you build your dam, you're going to displace people.
Thank you very much for joining us here on the Monocle Weekly, Judith.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And The War is in the Mountains is out this week.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time, make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Time for some music now. In a moment, we'll be hearing from Booker T. Jones, the leader of Booker T. and the MGs, who's had a hand in the careers of everyone from Otis Redding to Bob Dylan to Neil Young. And he's also played on this one. This is Sam and Dave with Hold On, I'm Coming.
Sam and Dave there from 1966 with Hold On, I'm Coming. We'll be hearing from Booker T. Jones after this.
As the band leader of Booker T and the MGs, Memphis musician Booker T. Jones has helped create some of the most unmistakable classics from the 60s and 70s. Not only did he craft hits for the MGs such as Green Onions and Time is Tight, not to mention the well-loved Soul Limbo, known to cricket fans around the world, of course, but the MGs were also the Stax Records house band, playing on standards from the likes of Otis Redding, Sam and Dave, as you just heard, and more.
Booker later worked with musicians ranging from Bill Withers to Neil Young and Bob Dylan, and he's still making albums today. This weekend he was at the Cheltenham Jazz Festival in the UK, and before that Monocle's Tom Hall caught up with him to talk about making records and how to play them to the crowd.
I like to give the audience something unique, something that only they experience, and something only that I experience. And of course, the energy from the audience will be different every time. But I like to give the audience a look at my history, at the music that influenced me as a young boy and that still influences me, and music that I was involved in creating the original of.
Of course. And I mean, that story, the Stax record story and all the interesting things you've done since, I mean, is that going to be on show? Is this a real Stax show that you play, or do you go into lots of different directions?
I go into lots of different directions. I'm not supposed to, but I have so many different influences. I have a jazz influence. When I was a boy, I loved listening to the Jazz Messengers and Ray Charles play jazz. I have a heavy blues influence when I was a kid. Jimmy Reed was one of my big influences. I have a classical influence. So I like to get up and play blues on guitar, and I like to play the Hammond organ. I started learning classical music on the Hammond B3 organ. That's my main focus on stage, is the music that I participated with in Booker T and the MGs, and the music that I helped create as a keyboardist, as a sideman.
I wanted to talk about your role in bands, because you are obviously known as the leader of Booker T and the MGs, but one of the things that really strikes me about your career, and I'm a fan, but I'm always stumbling on things that I did not know you were a part of. And part of that, I guess, is because the MGs, they had this dual role, didn't they? They were a band in themselves, but they were also, you know, very much the house band of Stax Records, so they would pop up on lots of other people's records.
Exactly.
I mean, how do you perceive the role of band leader? Do you think that a band leader needs to be a big showy front man, or do you think that it's kind of maybe more healthy to be that guy sitting nearly to the side and just keeping things ticking over and making sure that things are running right? What kind of role do you like to sit in?
I think the first band leader that I saw was Count Basie, who was sitting down at the piano the whole time. However, I worked with many band leaders in Memphis, Tough Green, Gene Bolex, Miller, Willie Mitchell, who was the first band leader to let me on stage, and they were all players. They all participated. They didn't stand up and conduct. You know, it's a difficult role to define, that of a band leader. You know, we have Duke Ellington and those guys that used to get up and dance in front of the band, you know. I do some of all of that, and I've enjoyed some of all of that. You know, the role of the band leader is similar to the music producer on stage. Whatever gets the group to do it correctly and to do it with energy and verve.
And of course, I mean, among all that, though, the frontman is an absolutely vital role of many bands. And you really have worked with some incredible talents over the years. I mean, Otis Redding and Sam and Dave and Bill Withers. And as I say, lots more, which I was not even quite aware of. I mean, you've even played in bands for Bob Dylan and people like that. I mean, can you talk us through perhaps what playing a show with Otis Redding was like? How did that differ from maybe playing a show with Bill Withers? What did Otis really bring?
The experience with Otis was short-lived. The beginning years were only studio years. I met him when I was in college, so the first 3 years we didn't interact so much because I was studying and I only went to Memphis on weekends. The band that he was able to tour with was the Bar K's and another band. I never was in the touring band till near the end when we played Your Country, and that was an amazing experience. That was heightened energy on stage than I had seen him perform with the other bands. But he was definitely a leader on stage and intent on delivering the best performance every moment of every show. Shake it like a bowl of soup, yeah. But it was fun, and it was interesting, and one of the best times of my life.
Tell me a little bit about some of your favorite musicians over the years that music has brought you into contact with. Was there anyone where you never thought you'd ever have a chance of working with, and then you found yourself in the studio with them?
Yes, I found myself on stage with Elton John and in the studio with Lou Reed. I never thought he would answer my call, but he did.
Was Lou Reed an easy man to work with? He had a reputation for being a little bit surly and a little bit moody.
For about two-thirds of the session, he was cantankerous, and then I didn't give up, and then he succumbed to me. I think I wore him out. To be totally honest, I think he was genuinely interested in the lyrics. I read the lyric over the phone to him, and I think that's the reason he agreed to come to the studio. My daughter wrote a lyric about the contributions of the Bronx and New York to the arts, and I think he really is at heart just a diehard artist, and he just wants what's best, and that's just his modus operandi. So he did come to the studio, so that meant that he really wanted to be involved. So, you know, that's what I went on. He wouldn't be here if he didn't want to be here.
Is that all you need, Booker? Someone to show up? Is that the only level of commitment that you need for someone to work with you?
That's an interesting point, because Bill Withers showed up, and his opinion of himself was that he was a songwriter. And he asked me who was going to sing the songs, and I said, you are. You're going to sing, Bill. And he actually just marched right into the studio, right to the microphone, and began to sing. That was his debut. That was the first time he sang.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away, I wonder this time where she's gone.
And do you think that music still has the power to inspire maybe like social change? I mean, I know that Booker T and the MGs, there's been a lot of talk about the fact that it was this multicultural, sort of multi-ethnic band at a time, certainly in the South, where that was not such an accepted thing. I mean, do you think that music still plays that role? Like it can still educate and bring people together and break down boundaries. Do you think it still has that capability?
Well, I'll agree with the first part of the sentence, that the music still has power. As far as power for social change, I really can't comment on that. It seems that the music of the 60s had power for social change, because social change was just pertinent in the 60s, and in the States at least. Social change, that's a difficult one. You know, that seems to gather impetus and then lose it and gather it through the years. So, but I think music always has power. I don't think it ever loses power, because everybody uses it for everything, for weddings, funerals, for their own enjoyment, and it's just inherent power that'll never go away.
I was reading an interview a few years back, I think it must have been around 2012 maybe, and you were quite hopeful with Barack Obama in the White House, and you were hopeful that music would be encouraged more in education to shape the outlook of young people. Have you seen that happen? And you know, or do you think that the current presidency that we're left with now is going to see a lot of arts cuts, and maybe that again is something that the US is going to have to work harder on?
That particular subject was a challenge when I spoke about it then, and it still is. It was happening before President Obama. It had to do, I think, with budgets around the world getting tight and people taking sports and music out of the early school programs. And that's something that I'm actively working on now, to get money from other places for kids to have instruments and to have other resources for learning music.
As I was saying earlier, you're on so many recordings, and we know you well for your well-known ones, but are there any where you might have played an instrument, and you play so many instruments? I mean, are there any that you've played on where you think people should be more aware that you had a hand in that song? I mean, which are some of your favorite recordings that people might not know you for?
I think the most obscure two recordings are Bob Dylan's Knockin' on Heaven's Door.
I did not know that.
Yeah, that's the one that I played bass on.
Mama put my guns in the ground. I can't shoot them anymore. That long black cloud is coming down. I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door.
And Rufus and Carla Thomas, 'Cause I Love You, I played baritone sax on that song.
I was reading about that, and I understand you borrowed that instrument from your own school program. Is that right?
I did. And that's why I'm working with the Recording Academy to get instruments in schools again. Yeah, if I hadn't had that bass, I don't know how I would have gotten into the industry. I mean, if I hadn't had that baritone sax at the school there.
Let's talk about an absolutely monolithic song, which you're obviously well known for, Green Onions. Do you still get pleasure from playing that song? Because everyone still gets enormous pleasure hearing it, but I wonder whether, have you played it so many times that you, have you ever not played it at a show?
No, I'm glad to hear everybody gets enormous pleasure hearing it, because it's always a challenge for me. It's probably one of the hardest songs that I play. It's just a complicated little pattern that sounds very simple, and I try to teach it to people, and they always have trouble learning it. It's deceptively simple, but it is probably one of my favorite songs of all time still.
That's a great thing, isn't it? I mean, for a song to be with you that long and you still enjoying it. I also just wanted to know, because obviously you have played it many times, maybe some of the variations. What's the longest rendition of Green Onions you've ever played?
Oh, probably on stage with Creedence Clearwater back in the early 70s when we were jamming together. They had a factory out there in Oakland where they would jam, and we just play it all night. And that we were jamming on that song. I don't know how long it lasted, 30 minutes, 20 minutes, something like that. Yeah.
And then what's the worst rendition of Green Onions you've played? Has it ever gone horribly wrong?
It has gone extremely, unbelievably wrong. I showed up at Shreveport, and I will never forget this night. And they, you know, I guess they told the people at Stax that Booker T needs an organ. And so they had an organ for me, and it was a pipe organ.
Oh, my God.
And there it was, and that was what I was supposed to play, Green, and that was just impossible. It will not speak. It will not speak fast enough to play that song.
Booker T. Jones there, talking to Monocle's Tom Hall. And the Cheltenham Jazz Festival, which Booker just performed at, continues on Monday with performances from Gregory Porter, Snarky Puppy and more. You're tuned in to The Monocle Weekly.
Each week on The Foreign Desk, we take a look at a single story, we find two or three great guests, and then we try to work out what's going on. It might be the story that's dominating the news that week.
The main thing they wanted to do was to stop, to get rid of Obama. How are you going to negotiate with that?
It might be something we think everyone else is ignoring.
Children, elderly, it doesn't matter. Anybody that is leaving the country is going to be shot.
Either way, the format's the same. Guests who know their stuff, talking knowledgeably, so that you and me end up knowing a little bit more than we did before. That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time and available at any time on monocle.com.
Lebanese artist and architect Nadim Karam is staging his first exhibition, Urban Stories, at the Fine Arts Society here in London until the 19th of May. A sculptor, painter and urbanist based in Beirut, Nadim is founder of Atelier Hapsitus, a group of architects and designers looking to use creativity to enliven in cities.
And joins us now to talk about his work. Nadim, welcome to The Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
And congratulations on this new show at the Fine Arts Society. Let's tackle all of those jobs that we gave you in our introduction first, okay? A sculptor, a painter, an urbanist, and you do a lot of public
That's
artwork
true.
As well.
Very much.
Is this a different little trap in your brain working for each of these things, or is it all a happy melting pot up there?
You know, they do link all together, painting, sculpture, and public art. But I'm concentrating, or I'm going even more into cities because I enjoy, you know, the streets, the life that it could create. And I think it's not a bad idea to have art in the city, to have art in the streets, to have art in public areas that could be enjoyed by everybody. Because cities need joy, they need festivity, they need people to interact with the work and create their own stories.
I'm wondering, is there a specific kind of art that works the best in public spaces in different cities if you want to bring there some joy and some fun?
I think as long as we avoid the idea of a monument where you don't have any reaction to it or it just imposes itself on you, then it's fine, because creating a set of objects or issues that generate stories and can bring to your mind the joy effect, like they could be figurative as much as they could be abstract, but I feel very much that they should be coming out from the specificity of the place, from the memory of the place, and intermingle with some new ideas that are provided in for people to question them. You know, when you put something in a public domain, you're already in a democratic system, because everybody can comment. Everybody say, I hate it, or I like it, or I don't want to have this in my face, or it creates already something that happens. And that's very exciting in cities, especially where it can bring joy, I'm saying.
Well, we hope so, because actually a lot of the case for public art, a lot of the case of public art, is that it gets walked past every day by millions of people looking at their iPhones and making sure their briefcase isn't bashing into everybody else, isn't it? That's sadly the story of public art. There is something about public art that actually needs to sort of grab you by the balls a bit, right? In order to get noticed at all.
Definitely.
Is that something that you have to factor in? I mean, site-specific works are things that obviously, you know, maybe grow like a tree out of the site that they're put in. Do you have to think about that?
Yeah, definitely. I have to think about all the factors. I mean, in fact, whenever I have to put a public art sculpture or something like that in a city, I would rather visit it on different occasions. And there's always a place
creep
that attracts
up on it
me.
When it's not looking.
Yeah. It's just important to have this outlook at the space and then get little by little to know about the contradiction of the space itself. And based on that, I introduce the work I would like to put there and see how it can generate stories and bring, you know, questions to the mind of people, because this monotonous life from 9 to 5 or all of this need to be challenged. And it's usually challenged on the street of a city.
Yeah.
And what kind of research do you conduct when you get a project, when you go to a city you may not know that well, you want to create something there? How do you work to actually understand the way people think and how they feel about the place they live in?
I mean, first, I have to live it myself. It means I have to go through its streets. I have to, the five senses have to work together so that the smell of the place, the, you know, the stories that are around the place, the touch of the things around it, the dirtiness, the cleanness of the place, all of these factors are important. But besides that, in fact, in the office at Hapsitos, as you were saying, we do a thorough research on the history and the memories of the place itself in order to be able to extract the specificities and add to them something new, something different that comes from outside the culture itself. And this is how people react to things, because there's something they really know there, but there are new factors that just came and jumped in and contrasted with the whole thing. And those new factors will react and will make people react to them.
Now, we're talking kind of in grand terms about these things, because yeah. that's how they end up. But they start as a line on a piece of paper.
Yeah,
and as part of your show at the Fine Arts Society, you're showing some of your works on paper, your sketchbooks and things like
yes.
that. That makes most artists feel naked, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Here's my first thought I had.
Yeah.
What sort of editing process has that been like for you? And I presume you haven't laid your eyes on these notebooks for a while, maybe.
I mean, it's very true. I mean, when Pippa and Sarah, the directors of the Fine Arts Society, came to visit me in Beirut, I had never until now showed any of my sketchbooks, works on paper. And they insisted that this should be part of the show because, you know, this show is...
People love to see that.
Yeah, people love to see that. And I was quite astonished because really, for me, it all starts on that paper that we were talking about. I mean, sketches are continuously generated and they do create the big projects that we're talking about because they're simple ideas that usually I draw when I'm in a plane or on a journey somewhere. And from there on, they move to painting, sculptures, and those big projects in cities. So it's the essence of everything somewhere and goes on. You know, I have so many sketchbooks. There is hundreds of them, which is interesting that one of them now got out from the closet. So it's quite
making
nice.
A bid for freedom.
Yeah. I mean,
how different are the works as they end up being as that original drawing?
Quite different, in fact.
I mean, in most cases.
Yeah, because the sketch is a spontaneous thing that has to be corrected and taken, because the process goes into different parts, you know. From the sketch, it's scanned, it goes into computer, and then we have to generate structures for them because of the scale. I'm doing now sculptures of 12-meter heights and different others, I mean. And then the detailing becomes very important. The tackling of the material itself. If I'm working with stainless steel, then how do the screws get in and all of the system, the welding process. So in order for a sketch to become a sculpture, there is a whole process will go through different people until you get to the end product. So it's different, but it's an exciting process. I mean, it's gentrified, if you want, from the spontaneity of the thing itself. Suddenly you have, a work that's completely different. But
such a different material.
Yeah, because, you're dealing with other material, with metals, with heavy things. It's completely different.
One of the specific works is Trou de Mémoire.
Yeah.
Good name. Yeah. But what is that? Because this is something that, this is a large-scale work, isn't it? It's something that very much involves the viewer.
Yeah, in fact, Trou de Mémoire is a French word that means lapse in memory. So there is a hole in the memory. But in fact, it's a sculpture which is interesting. It's super shiny and is about two big circles. One is memory and one is void. And they do stand face to face. And the memory is full of patterns and stories and things, while the void is completely empty and could reflect so many possibilities of things. So the memory also shows the sketches from 1993 till now. And if you stand in
between...
So there's
a bit of soul-searching there, right?
Yeah, I mean, there is thought-searching. Yeah. In fact, there is another work called Stretching Thought, which is interesting. But you stand inside there and you look at the void, which is completely empty. And what you see? You see the reflection of memory. And each one interpreted depending on how they feel about their own memory, about their own life, about their own journey.
And how much has your thinking changed? That sketchbook we mentioned, it's from 1993. When you look at those pages now, do you feel that? Do you still recognize yourself drawing those? Or are you thinking that you would have done something differently?
And you just have to get out the dust from the cover and look at it again, I mean, and say, wow, I mean, these little figures that I used to draw. You know, in those days, I would find a book that I like, for example, and even use the papers on which there are already a few lines, and add to them the colors and the figures that I use. So, it's quite different from... I've changed a lot since then, and I think it shows. When you are in the, if you happen to see the show, you will see those sketches and you will see the very latest work that I have only seen when I reached London, because the production was in Frankfurt. It came directly here. So I had the chance to see it a couple of days ago. So it's quite from 93 till now, plus yeah. a survey of so many things in between. It's quite interesting.
And when you came in, you were talking about your nice sashimi luncheon that you enjoyed yeah. today. You spent 10 years living in Japan,
yes.
and that's part of your, you know, the artist's CV.
We
all want to try and find meaning in your CV, you know, and yeah. well, he did this, so that's why he's done that. Was that art school in Japan, or was that just fun
games?
No,
I did my architecture studies. I did my uh-huh. master's and my PhD there, so that's why it's 10 years of studies there. It's quite phenomenal, but...
Did that change the way you thought?
Definitely.
I mean, the architecture study is one way of thinking.
Yeah.
Did living in Japan make you feel and think a certain way?
Because, you know, culturally it's quite different, mm. although it's all Asia, from Lebanon to Japan, belongs to the Orient. Mm. So it was not that foreign to me, and there are deep cultures. Japanese culture is about 5,000 years old and more. Same goes for Lebanon, from Byblos on and all these times. But the philosophy is different in the sense of the religion. Like you have the Zen Buddhism there, which is very important, while in Lebanon you have Christianity and Islam. So from monolithic God, one God, to a diversity of gods that's there, that's a completely different issue, which enriches your mind with different ways of looking at things. I think also the simplicity of the Japanese spaces are very important, plus also the ceremonies that they have, the tea ceremony, the no dance, and so many other factors that are unique to Japan, and I think have created some uniqueness to my work.
And as an artist, do you know when you're being influenced by something, or does it kind of seep through your work over the months, over the years, or is it something that you can explicitly see as an influence?
I think art is a journey also, you know, and this journey takes you to so many places and at the same time makes you create so many different other things. And it's so important to be constantly on this journey, to move from one place to another and to be able to interact with the places you've reached, and they inspire you in one way or another. And still you come back to your place, to my atelier in Beirut, where I have got so many influences from different places, and get to digest them, if you want, and put them into new works. It works like that, definitely.
Well, where does your journey continue next? Where's your focus after this exhibition?
You know, after this exhibition, I'll be in Yerevan, Armenia, where I'm installing works in the Lovers Park. And soon after, I'm going to Japan to install also large-scale sculptures at the Nissan headquarters. And then, I mean, it's interesting because it's just traveling.
Yeah, tell us about that. How does that work?
It's traveling. I'm going to Suzhou near Shanghai, uh-huh. where I'm installing about 200 penguins suspended from the central atrium of a space. And then to Kuwait, where I have different other projects ongoing. So it's just traveling around and getting projects.
When you
realized.
Say you have some good ideas on planes, you weren't kidding.
No, it's true.
It's
like
the
that.
Number 30 bus
like
here, right?
Yeah. It happens like that. I mean, it's true.
There is so much going on for you, and indeed, Urban Stories is at the Fine Arts Society here in London until the 19th of May. Thank you very much, Nelly, for joining us here on the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Marcus, that was good, wasn't it? Did you like all of the ingredients that went into that little soup?
I thought we had first-class ingredients this time. Time went past really quickly.
That is the measure, isn't it, of anything? What about? Okay, let's talk about very quickly before we go. Things that are improved with not. I hasten to use the word length,
mm-hmm.
but not all good things are short things, are they?
No, not all. Not at all.
Well, I got that.
Do
over
you want
with.
To go into details?
Okay. Well, we got that over with quickly. He says he rolled his lover out of bed.
No. Anyway.
Marcus, if he blushes well, the fins blush well.
Changing the topic. What have you planned for this afternoon then, Rob?
I thought I'd go down to the Cheltenham Jazz Festival. I'm sure there is a fast train from Paddington to take me there to maybe hear the tail end of Big Gregory Porter's set.
That sounds really good. I'm going to continue with a very late Sunday brunch, and I don't know, just enjoy my time off.
Nice sounds.
Exactly. Nice Sunday.
Nice Sunday sounds. Shall we thank our pals behind the glass?
I think it would be fair. So, today's show was produced by Tom Hall and researched by Helena Gerrit. Our studio manager was Claire Urban, thanks to all of them. The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week, but for now it's goodbye from me, Marcus Hippi.
And me, Robert Pound. Thanks for tuning in.